Thanks for listening to the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour. 1 hour of tips from experts and real stories from people just like you. For those thinking about what lies ahead, for those going through the job search, and those who have paved the way to their next career after the military. These professionals are dedicated to helping you move forward successfully to the next phase of your career after the military. Welcome to Exchange.
As we kick off our show, we always start with somebody who is either planning or in the soup. I love the saying, in the soup, you're truly flying by instruments. I learned to play golf and my father said, you're going to learn how to do 1,000 things all at once just to hit a little white ball. And I think that being in the soup and transitioning is taking everything you've learned and putting it into effect during that process. So I'd like to introduce you to somebody who is active duty AGR, Kevin Doe Croson. Hey, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for having me today. Appreciate the opportunity to chat.
You are a maverick on LinkedIn. You are out and about. And the reason I found you is because you have such a voice in this community. And I was kind of amazed to learn that you're not transitioning out for at least 2 more years. So talk to us about what you're doing to sort of pregame your transition.
So for me, it really began at the end of my first sergeant time. I knew during and upon conclusion, that was the pinnacle of my career. Nothing was going to be better than that. And that I'm not hanging around to chase the next level. So that put me about 4 years out to be like, okay, I've come to terms, I've made peace, but coming from a marketing and branding background, I went to University of Florida for a master's in mass communication and social media. So I was like, I need to apply everything that I've been doing professionally to myself. And I started just leaving breadcrumbs, getting my name out there, just learning from others, meeting people in the veteran community. And it's really started to spiral upward. And thus far, it's working well. I'm less than 1,000 days out from retirement.
Do you have a countdown? Do you have one of those timers that you carry around with you?
Got an app on my phone.
Right? What's your plans? What are you thinking that you're going to be doing post-military?
So I've been in recruiting since 2009. But as I mentioned, digital marketing has been kind of my passion. It's what most of my career achievements are based around. So I really want to pivot into that arena, whether it be public affairs, social media, or digital marketing more broadly. Honestly, my ultimate goal is to work remote. I have a 5-year-old son. As far as having a young son when I retire, which is unusual, most of my peers have grown kids or teenagers. So I'll have from 8 to 18 an opportunity to sit in one place and be a part of his life with maximum potential, which is something I wouldn't have been able to do PCSing, you know, around every 2 to 3 years as I have been, you know, for the previous decade. Remote work and quality of life are my top priorities. I'm open. I'm a free agent. You know, I'd love to do something that I'm passionate about. And that's why I've gone really super niche and worked to get my name out there and be a part of this community, especially on LinkedIn.
And you're doing a great job. I mean, I was amazed how many people when we connected, we knew in common. And they're all the movers and shakers in the military to civilian career transition space. So good job. I look forward to seeing what you do. But again, you've got 2 years. So as someone who's written a book who tells you to, you know, check this out 3 years in advance, you're really doing what I hoped more people would do. Advantages of this are that you will come into the transition with more confidence. As a corporate recruiter, I saw so many people without that confidence, and it came through in ways that could truly, truly hurt them. They could not negotiate a salary, say, for example. Their LinkedIn or their resumes really didn't reflect the work they could do. They really didn't know what they wanted to do. So hats off to you to figure that out. Are you taking any certifications or taking advantage of any of your education opportunities before you leave? Are you certing up in a sense?
I am not in terms of certifications. Most of the ones that are relevant to the career field that a lot of my peers have are project managements out there, the SHRM certifications. I'm familiar with all those. With me going into the marketing side, and I'm actually spending most of my free time teaching as a professor at a West Virginia university. So I've been leaning more into building my resume with experience, with guest speaking engagements and teaching, as opposed to certifications. But I'm a big fan of certifications. I maxed out my education benefits, got a master's degree from University of Florida, you know, go Gators. It may be naive. It's not something that I've focused on. I have a Hootsuite certification, which is more in line with with my niche, but there isn't a ton of like recognized certifications like PMP or SHRM in the marketing and social media space, at least not yet.
How comfortable are you with AI taking over a lot of what you do in the next few years before you get out?
AI still needs prompts. And that's actually the class that I teach is with West Virginia is emerging technology in the customer journey. So this is actually a topic of discussion I have on a weekly basis. I'm confident that there will still be a need for the human brand voice. And AI can only be so authentic, especially as we move into VR, AR, metaverse, you know, type things that are evolving, the evolution of smart objects. As society, as we get more advanced, people still crave human interaction and true authenticity, which is part of the reason why TikTok has become such a predominant platform for individuals. It would be quite difficult for AI to, or virtual influencers to be as effective on a platform like TikTok. And you know, and when it comes to community building, we need that human touch to really interface with our target market and our community.
As these generative AI models grow, any language model has the opportunity to grow, and the fear is that it'll grow beyond us. How do you address that with your students? And again, you're a couple of years out. This is happening at such a rapid pace. What's the what if? What's the plan B, C, D, E? What if there is no digital marketing in 2 years? What's your plan?
I do have my 15 years of recruiting background with Army Recruiting, and I've really leaned into not being a run of the mill. One of my favorite books is Rebel Talent, which is a Harvard author that does case studies on people that buck the system and innovate. I like to think of myself along that vein as someone who has found better mousetraps, innovated, and found new ways to be just another guy. You know, and that's something that, as far as my personal branding and marketing, that's my plan B, is to showcase what I've done on the recruiting side, because that's another skill that is very human oriented. There's a lot of screeners, you know, robot screeners out there for resumes, but I don't think they're quite at the point, as you said, you know, they're coming for that job too. But again, I still think no matter how much AI takes over, there's still going to need to be somebody there for human interaction. I don't know if it's going to get to that point where it's human-esque.
Right. It's going to be an AI generated human-esque conversation. We're already starting to see that. One of my favorite things to do with new clients as an HR consultant is I always check their chatbots. What do you know? You know, I ask them impossible questions, and then I tell the clients, your chatbots are not answering the key questions regarding the careers or HR questions that they could. So thanks for bringing that up. One of the things that I see, and you probably see this too, is you're bringing people into the service, and now you're going to be advocating for people leaving the service with skills, is that they have a hard time going from the we construct to the me construct. How do you approach that? And what are your thoughts on that?
My branding brain kicks in. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I've went to school for and learned and have practical experience in how to create a brand voice and how to pitch a brand and grow a community for a brand. And I think applying that same sort of marketing and branding logic to oneself has been advantageous. You know, it's very similar concepts of building an individual brand versus an organizational brand. That can help a lot of people. What can I do to establish my brand so my brand is notable, something that someone's going to want in, you know, less than 3 years from now? You mentioned having confidence. I'm also wary. I don't want to be overconfident. I don't want to have hubris and go into this thinking that I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, because I know there are a lot of differences from the civilian sector, you know, from what I've done. But being in teaching, I've kind of been able to you know, peek into the other side and interface with students who are, you know, either in that sector or going into that sector.
You and I were talking before we hit the record button about things that are missing. What could be fixed?
A theme that I've seen a lot of people talk about is just starting earlier. I would advocate for training on even something as simple as LinkedIn earlier in your career when people become junior NCOs, because the value in a profile is not in what your resume says more often, it's in who is connected to it. Mm-hmm. So a scenario I pitch to students or to even, you know, junior NCOs, if you were to get a recommendation on your LinkedIn profile for a decade, for every rater and senior rater that you have, you don't know who those raters and senior raters are going to become. They could be CEOs, executive directors, they could be corporate recruiters. You don't know who they're going to be. You're building your resume for who your network is going to become, because they're going to get there before you. I think if we were to influence that transition process and start training people that, hey, your resume or LinkedIn Connect community or profile isn't something that you can just throw together in 6 months at the end. You know, if you spend 5-10 years, you know, working to get those recommendations and endorsements and really explore it to find your niche, I think they would have a better resource of recommendations that can be used and add legitimacy to their profile.
I've heard a saying throughout my career, those who want the job will get the job. And for me, here's recruiter to recruiter, right? I'm trying to get people jobs after the service. You're trying to get people into the service. But we're still trying to recruit people. And mm-hmm. as recruiters, we're trying to make a fit. But there's only so much I can do, because I'm a gatekeeper for, say, a corporation. You are a gatekeeper for a much larger corporation or organization. So we can't give them the keys to the castle. What are you seeing as you recruit people in that are missing? And again, this show is not about getting into the military. It's about mm-hmm. leaving the military and, sure. and staying employed post. But what are you seeing as deficits for people coming in?
So there is a big shift since I started recruiting in terms of what is a more powerful incentive. The old way of, you know, just throwing huge bonuses and money at it, as we've seen over the last few years, has become less effective and less enticing. I've interacted with plenty of younger folks that are not as swayed by a whole bunch of dollar signs. So the value proposition of what the military can offer is viewed very differently by an up and coming generation. And I think that's also reflected to some extent on the civilian job market as well, as we shift more towards quality of life issues as opposed to stock options and bonus packages. Even for myself, as I mentioned earlier, my number one priority is remote work and quality of life so I can hang out with my son. And I think that's probably more reflective as a wider cultural shift. And that's especially more dominant amongst the younger group.
Agreed. And that's happening in the workplaces too. Candidate attraction is what we call it. And you're having the same issues. People are not entering the workplace in the same ways. The corporations are shifting, they're reorganizing because of that. And dollars aren't going to do it. Quality of life, core values, ethics, what do they feel? They're very purpose driven, especially the younger generation. But for those of you who are, say, millennials, Gen Xers getting out of the military, the old standards still apply. I mean, I want to say that millennials, Gen X, even boomers, they work very hard. They still want the attaboy, you know, good job. But they're really working because it feels good. This new generation sets boundaries better than anyone I've seen. The Gen Zers, even the later millennials, and then Gen A, the ones in high school right now, they're going to be completely different because they have so many options. So they can go into alt finance, they can become YouTube stars, they can do so many things independently that they might not need that big structure like a military or a corporation. Mm-hmm. So getting their attention, I feel like what we're trying to do is just get everybody's attention, right? Let's talk about timing, because this is something that you fall into this camp. You're a few years out and you know, because you're a recruiter, you shouldn't start applying for jobs. What are you doing instead of hitting the apply button? Because it's way too early. What are you doing in order to make those avenues, those introductions, and warm up those relationships with companies you could work with?
I've been hitting the guest speaker circuit. I've been a guest at Military Influencer Conference, a Social Media Strategy Summit. And again, it's just opportunities to help share my experiences and expertise. And that has helped put me in front of some important eyes. It's also a creative outlet and a professional fulfillment outlet to do things like that. I'm the founder and president of the University of Florida's Association of Military Alumni. They surprisingly did not have a military or veteran alumni association. So took it, confused me too. It was very surprising. So took it upon myself. It's been a huge exercise in networking and getting the word out and pulling together two of my favorite worlds, the Gator community and the military community. So that, you know, that has given me a lot of a kind of practice, you know, especially launching something from ground zero. The third thing is has been teaching. Having an actual second job keeps me sharp, something that keeps me challenged, keeps me in front of new audiences. So that's kind of been my three-tiered approach, in addition, obviously, to the LinkedIn presence. And that's more about just providing value. Again, I know the, you know, key element in establishing a brand or establishing a following is not, you know, endless promotion. It's providing value, you know, sharing stories that people want to read, providing tips and guidance and support, you know, that is going to help people on their journeys. So that's what I'm striving to do. And I think the better I can do that, I'm hoping that the more marketable that will make me in the end.
I agree. I think you're doing a good job. I'm thrilled that you joined us, Kevin. And I just want to say thank you. It sounds like you're not having any difficulties. I'd love to bring you back as you enter your first full year of post-military civilian work. You'll probably be running all the shows and all the podcasts and doing marketing for big, big things. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and really your plan. I think you've got a lot going on. What I'd like you to do is spell your name, because a lot of folks are listening to us. So how do you spell your name, and are you open to people getting in touch with you to network?
Oh, absolutely. CROWSYN. Crow like a bird, SYN. I'm at Kevin Croson on most major platforms. You can find me on LinkedIn, kevincroson.com, little website with my bio and media engagements and whatnot. Cool. Absolutely. Open to network, open to assist. I want to help as much as I can, but also I know I have a lot to learn. So I appreciate this opportunity to come and learn from you and get an opportunity to discuss these things with other veterans. I am by no means an expert in this space, but I have a very specific niche skill set that I hope I can apply the best I can. And I'll be reading your book here. It's next on my list.
Thank you, sir. You got quite a few things spread out, and I think you've got a lot of contingency plans. I'm not going to worry at all about you, Kevin. Thank you so much for your time today. I'm Cheryl Cross. You're listening to the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour. We're just ending our segment on someone who is planning or in the soup. Our next segment will be someone who is an expert, someone who gives back to this community, and we'll be right back after this very brief break. And we're back. Hi, I'm Cheryl Cross. I'm your host of the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour, and we are at the expert segment. I have a woman that I recently met, and after about 35 minutes of talking to her on the phone, I left that conversation thinking, I really need to have her on the podcast. She is like a warm hug. She is a licensed mental health counselor for the state of Florida, but she is also a coach. I'd like to introduce you to Anne Greco. Hey, Anne, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Cheryl. Thank you so much for having me here to talk on your podcast.
We talked about so many things before I hit the record button. Stress and anxiety is one. People coming either out of the military or have served in the military. I just want to open the door for you to sort of talk about what you may impart to this group if they're going through a difficult transition.
I specialize in working with people to help them manage their stress. And of course, stress, we know, if it's not properly managed, can progress into anxiety. And with a lot of things that are related to mental health, they start out at one level and then they worsen over the course of time. A lot of that happens is because people have a tendency to internalize their feelings, especially if they feel and have been exposed to environments where they have had to keep things together, they have had to be strong, they're acting in the capacity of leadership. I specialize in the type of anxiety that leaders and executives and business owners who are responsible and accountable for people and situations and negotiations, their stress is very unique. It's different than other types of stress. At the same time, although they do a great job of managing and carrying the responsibility, they can sometimes suffer. They have a tendency to be people who can give and put everything and everybody ahead of themselves. And learning how to create a balance, learning how to realize what's happening in your body, what you need, how to develop healthy expression and outlet so that you do not internalize the feelings, is probably the most basic and first step to being able to keep a handle on stress. I don't believe stress is going away, not for anybody. And most of the people that I talk to would never take their foot off of the gas pedal, even if I asked them to. Lounging and reclining is not something that they do, whether they're active in the military or whether they retire from the military. In fact, many of the families that I have worked with and the people who have retired from the military are actually just as active. They find community involvement. They sometimes find work in the private sector. They still travel. They still make a difference in the world. Mission and purpose in life continues on. And if that is balanced, it is wonderful. And they feel great about themselves. They feel relevant. And that is something that I want to educate people on. If we understand mental health, if we help people address it and really be open about it, we can prevent the progression of it to where it gets to the point where people struggle to function. And they feel sad and left out, isolated. Leaders, people in leadership, I find, can feel a little more isolated. There's not as many of them as there are the rest of the troops, the rest of them, or the company or the team.
I could talk about everything that you said about relevance and purpose and drive. But what I want you to unpack more is when leaders feel that they have to lead and they take this mission mindset from the military into the civilian world. The civilian world is more of an I, mm-hmm. and the military is all about we. It is the mission. It is the team. It is the squad. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I talk about this, it feels like, every segment, especially with the experts. So how might we help this community realize that it's important to concentrate on yourself? And at what point does that happen? I mean, I'm a proponent of starting your transition mindset 3 years in advance, which is an incredibly long period. It's usually 12 months, 180 mm-hmm. days. It's mm-hmm. not 3 years. But for you in your business, when you're dealing with mindset, you're dealing with potential post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injuries, you've got military sexual assault. I want to know, how might they start really thinking about themselves while they're active duty? How do they prepare?
I think that if we start with a foundation that taking care of oneself actually serves every other part of the mission, even if you function well no matter what, and I know that they function well under tremendous stress and pressure, feeling your best and being your best only gives you more to offer. And sometimes people overlook that part. And so they say, I must sacrifice and take from myself. And we definitely want to let them know, allowing time and ability for doing that, setting that example also for the team, for the group that looks up to them and really admires them for who they are and what they have accomplished.
When someone comes to you for coaching, how do you recognize they're not heading in the right path? What are you listening for?
I am listening for how they are thinking. In cognitive behavioral therapy, thought leads to feeling, which leads to behavior. So I am noticing how they're thinking, and I am matching it up to how they are wanting to think, and then work with them based on their goals and what they want to do. And a lot of times they will come to me because they have spoken to somebody who worked with me and noticed a profound shift in the person's approach or the way that they are thinking. And we just take it to the next level. And sometimes we talk more about the cognitive things, but then we also get into the EQ, emotional intelligence, and really start talking about that and what that definitely means. And then the other part is, how are they feeling and how are they learning to regulate emotions? Now, in this population, they are fantastic at regulating everything on the surface. And we just want to make sure that deep down, it's also congruent, that everything's congruent, and that they are also really regulating and expressing, developing expression, outlets, and the ability to engage in healthy situations. And also the ability, like you said, there is a we mentality, and they work together and they do bond really well with other people. So making sure that they have the social network that they desire and that they're used to working in. I look for, are they feeling isolated? Are they feeling like they can open up and talk and express themselves at a level where it's healthy? Or are they a little more backing off and just holding up front or holding up a facade so that they can maintain whatever it is that they're wanting to maintain? And eventually what we know is that eventually that comes out. If people are putting up, I'm not going to say it's a wall, but they're putting up an exterior that's very, very guarded or very strong always, you know, because there is a time to be vulnerable, and maybe not in the capacity of work, but in general, being able to be vulnerable. And sometimes what I'll hear, again, very tangible, that people will say to me, I sometimes have difficulty talking to my children or talking to my spouse or my friends who are not in the military. I sometimes feel like they don't understand what I'm thinking or how I look at things. They don't know what it's like because their antennae aren't up when they walk in a public place to really know where everybody is, yeah, and who's at the door and who's not at the door, and where to sit to position yourself in the event that something could happen, you know. And I've heard stories. Client many years ago was telling me about driving on the road. He said after his tour of duty and being back, the way that civilians drive was just not acceptable for him. It wasn't good driving. In Florida, we probably have a lot of people who don't drive well. We have a lot of tourists and we have a lot of seniors, but
in Hawaii too, for sure.
Yeah. And I think that we do live in a polite society sometimes where rules are not really observed. People do what they want to do. And the people that I speak with can experience frustration.
There's a very distinct set of rules in the military.
Yeah.
You break them, you get in trouble. That's universal.
You break them and you put everybody at risk. Yeah.
What are some of the red flags that you hear from clients that you'd like to share with us? Keep in mind that it's not just people leaving the military or have left the military, veterans. It's family members, it's dependents, it's people who love those folks or maybe serve in a clinical capacity or a healthcare capacity. We have a very broad audience. So share with us some of the things you hear that are red flag.
When you notice that somebody is in trouble, when you notice that they are barely hanging on in some ways, when you notice that they are having thoughts that they don't want to be here anymore, or thoughts that what they do or what they say, their presence doesn't matter, that they are somehow forgotten or overlooked. Those are flags, in my opinion. And of course, if anybody is saying that they're suicidal, I mean, that's an immediate one. No matter where I am, no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm in my office or not, I'm going to keep people safe.
How do you
now,
do that?
Now, some of the questions that I ask are going to sound like simple questions, but I always will ask people, are you sleeping okay? Are you eating okay? I will ask them those basic questions. I will monitor that even if that is not in their list of goals, kind of like a brief mental status, but I'll just ask it really informally because I believe that sleep is just so important to our own well-being. And I think also too, there can be something in the diet. If people are forgetting to eat, they're not eating, they lost their appetite, you know, those are some things that are pretty telling. They're very tangible to be able to track. I will ask about crying spells. I will ask them to open up and talk with me and just tell me the things that stress them out the most. So if I have somebody and I'm looking at them online, I'll look at how they're holding their shoulders. I'll look at their eye movement. Their eye movement can tell us a lot. Neurolinguistic programming gave us a lot of information that clarified what it means when people move their eyes and how they move their eyes. So I'll look at the nonverbal signals. Sometimes the sighs, if they have a sigh in between comments, if they hesitate to answer a question. When I'm sitting with them in person, it's interesting. I have an office that has a couch, and even for average height people, you cannot sit back on that couch without with your legs and then have your legs touch the floor. So there's pillows that people put there. And I'm thinking of one client who she had two pillows to be able to sit comfortably. And a lot of times people are perched when they sit down, and I'll notice that right away if they're ready to, you know, pounce.
You talk about hypervigilance. Not everybody has to go through combat or be injured to have hypervigilance. But it shows up in such weird ways. Mm-hmm. Talk more about this. You talked about someone not putting their back door, having a clear plan B. What if there was a situation? Always having a scenario driving their next step. That sounds exhausting to me. How do you work with somebody like that?
I would not necessarily tell them to change how they're looking at something. I would want to expand, though, their ideas about what they did or what they were involved in previously that brought them to the place where they were looking at things the way that they do, and then recognizing that there are other ways to look at that, especially if it's a hypervigilance. Although some people that I know really do notice what goes on in their public surroundings, and they don't really want to change that. They do like to be positioned in a certain place only for their own comfort and what they believe is ultimately could be their safety. There are things that I've heard them say that they wouldn't go certain places at certain times, like going into a convenience store after a certain hour. They just believe that the risk goes up.
Right.
You know, when you talk about risk management, they understand risk factors and know how to manage them. And so you don't necessarily, in my opinion, I don't think I would want to take everything and just scrap that. Although I would work with how they're feeling about it and want to give them some relief. And relief is very specialized. It's very individualized for every single person. What does that mean? And how does that look? And I think that that's how I get the results that I get when I work with people, is that it is so individualized and so specialized. And then what happens is they begin to feel better after we work together, that they begin to notice a sense of self-efficacy that increases. And then, of course, if they have any feedback, which a lot of times they do from people around them who notice something is different and better, it brings it all together and it helps them tremendously to have that feedback from.
I know you work with people who are working outside of their health system. So they're seeing you because if they were to go through their medical route, it would go on their record. I know pilots do this too for the airlines. So I've heard this in different industries. It's not just the military. When you do this kind of coaching, it seems to me that this is just such a wide open field. You have a huge playground with someone. And they probably don't know what they need. They just know that they need help. What does a standard assessment look like? You don't have to walk me through everything, but what are the first few steps of somebody engaging someone like you to have sort of a discovery call? Help me out here. How do you walk somebody through this process?
I would spend probably a pretty long time listening to what they want to say, what they have, what are the goals and what they want to accomplish. And of course, when I hear what they want and need, then I will share with them how I can help them. And so the relationship is built on that. Now, if I am talking to them and I take a lot of time and a lot of keen listening to do that. And then again, noticing the body language, et cetera. And if something isn't, you know, adding up, it sounds funny, but when I was doing work with the Department of Corrections as a therapist, we would look for things, to, what people said, to add up. And if something didn't add up or doesn't add up anytime, I will ask questions to clarify it and go as deep as I need to go until I'm satisfied that it starts to make sense and I'm getting the correct story and then the correct information. And I will always, you know, make sure that it's appropriate for them to work with me before I would even extend that invitation.
You have a 6-month minimum for your coaching. Tell us why that is.
I have done work with people who want to come in when they want to come in. And what will happen is we'll work for a little while, they'll feel a little better, but then it'll get worse again, and then they'll come and they come in. And I really found that the commitment and the accountability was really important, and that for most people, it takes 6 months. I tried a 3-month program because obviously it was less of an investment in time, money, and overall commitment for the person who is working with me. And I didn't like it as well. I found that they did get value from it, and they did believe that a lot got accomplished, and some things did get accomplished. It's just that it wasn't sustainable. And there's something about that extra couple of months that gives the sustainability. It gives them the confidence so that they are able to, handle if depression comes up, if anxiety comes up, if they had any history or issue with a panic attack or something like that, a depressive episode, they have the confidence and the tools to be able to manage it. The other thing that I should mention about the type of coaching and why it's coaching and not counseling with people in the program, my program, is that they can do a quick coach. So if they are somewhere and thinking of something, or there is something coming up, they can actually reach out to me and we will jump on the phone and handle that situation right then and there. There is a lot of exchange of information. And if there are materials that I think would help them, because there's growth and development, I find out what they like, what would influence them, how they learn, and then I will guide them in the direction to finding and identifying the resources. And I think that whole process over the course of 6 months, Cheryl, is what gives them the confidence. They almost feel like, well, if I had to teach somebody how to do this, I actually could. And probably after 6 months, who knows, they might be able, because a lot of the people that I work with are leaders and they're, you know, they disseminate information all the time and they learn, they're fast learners. So
you've got your own train the trainer program. I love that you shared before we hit the record button that you are available to them beyond the 6 months for no more money. That, yeah, you know, you have your set fee, and I would like you to reach to Anne directly for that. We're not going to broadcast her fees, but she's there. You know, it doesn't just end when the 6-month mark ends. Talk to us about that.
I want to make sure that we have really helped, you know, because that is the end goal. You know, even in a brief model therapy where we will have a designation and we'll say we'll get 6 sessions, and I did a lot of that work. I did it in substance abuse treatment. I did it in the Department of Corrections and other types of settings where we had a certain number and we had goals and we did as much work as we could. And it was measured, of course, by the number of sessions. And I'm taking it away from that because I want to make sure that the end goal gets met. And the point is that we want to help people, educate them, have them lower the anxiety of even managing any kind of a health condition, give them what they need to manage it, and then really have them be able to take over the reins. And then what they are doing is they are learning to take their life and make it therapeutic so that when different things come up, they know how to manage it. They know how to work with the people around them. They know how to work with their thoughts and feelings and even their environment. And when they make a plan, whether they make it way in advance or they make it 12 months in advance, or even for the tomorrow, if they map out goals every day, you know, they are putting in the things that they know that will help them really navigate the day in a way that they want to, so that when they look back on that day, they can feel you know, pretty good about it. And I also give them tools to help them kind of assess that. I put into that program, which I've never done that in other things that I have done with people, other work with clients. I teach them how to really self-assess certain things so that they can know and realize that is important to help them regulate and meet the goals that they're wanting to meet. And I always connect it back to things that are important to them, things that they want out of life, things that they enjoy or value. I believe that makes the most difference for people.
I love hearing you talk about this. I love just hearing the tone of your voice go up when you talk about it, how passionate you are and how dedicated you are to building this. You talked about the brief model therapy. I'm just going to say this is a blanket statement. I think society is all about the quick fix. It's the memes on Instagram and Facebook. It's the short videos on TikTok, which, by the way, our podcast doesn't support TikTok. It is YouTube videos. It is this constant stream of other information seeking answers. And that is a placebo, friends. I'm a huge fan of therapy. I advocate for it. I'm a super user of it myself as a neurodivergent woman. And I cannot tell you how hard it is to ask for help, but once you do, how easy it is to get it. It's like crawling over a fence that really is only a few feet high. You can step over it, but you think it's 1,000 feet in the air. It's not. Asking for help is a great strength. There's ANZ, there's people at your military family support centers, there's veteran service organizations, there's your commanders, hopefully. You've got leaders within your organization if you're still a service member. If you're in a veterans community, there's Veterati, American Corporate Partners, there's Hiring Our Heroes. There's so many. I couldn't even list them all. I mean, reach out and talk to any veteran, and I bet you 100% they'd pick up the phone within a few minutes to an hour to have a warm conversation with you. So if you're looking for a professional, Anne is, she's on the market, and she's developed this wonderful program that I learned about. And like I said, when I first talked to you, Anne, it was literally like I left that conversation like I had just been given a warm hug. And you truly are doing what you love, and it's obvious. I can hear it, and I can, for those of you who are watching her, you can see it. There is a military saying, and I end most of my segments this way, do you have any last alibis? How would you like to close up your segment?
I just want to thank everybody who listened and listened to the end and tell you that I really believe in you. I believe in your ability to develop resilience. I believe in your ability to overcome whatever challenges you are facing right now, and to let you know that there are people who are here and want to know about you and find out about you and want to connect meaningfully with you.
Thank you so much. That's beautiful. All right, I'm going to cry, but I have to close up the segment. So thank you so much for being with us all through this expert segment. Share this. Send this to your friends. Get the word out. We cannot talk enough about mental health. People who are serving in the military have served. Family members of those who are serving or have served. We're all part of one big unit of support. So thank you. My name is Cheryl Cross, and you're listening to the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour. We're ending our expert segment. We're going to be walking into meeting somebody who's been out at least a year, maybe no more than four. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Welcome to Exchange.
We're at the third segment of the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour. Hi again, I'm Cheryl Cross, your host, and I'm super excited to bring you the U.S. Air Force veteran, Steve Nesbitt. He's got a lot to talk to us about. In fact, I had to stop him and say, dude, let's hit the record button, share it. Just wait. So, hey, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today. I am here to ask you questions about your wonderful nonprofit, Shields and Stripes, but I want to know what led you to that. You know, this is all about transition, leaving the military, creating civilian work, getting into the civilian workforce. I'm really curious what brought you to create this big nonprofit you have. What were the circumstances?
As I transitioned out, the nonprofit wasn't like, man, you know what I really want to do is start a nonprofit. That wasn't the first thing that was on my mind. It was a typical, let's go get another job. Let's figure out what we're going to do to pay the bills. But what led down that pathway is I joined the Air Force in 2005. I joined to become a PJ or a pararescueman. There is a funny story about that whole process. I'll say that for another day. But as I entered into the Air Force, I got into the PJ career field. It's a 2.5-year pipeline. I finished that. I went to my first duty station out in Okinawa, Japan. Spent 3 years there, deployed once there, and then did a tsunami recovery out in the mainland Japan. That was 2001 when that tsunami hit the earthquake. And then went over to Las Vegas, Nevada, to the Nellis Air Force Base. Spent 3 years there and deployed a few times. And then as the war at least was winding down for that particular unit that I was at, as a rescue squadron, that's where we did one of injury missions. We were flying overseas, similar capabilities to a Navy SEAL. We jump out of planes, we fly in helicopters, we scuba dive, we combat divers, but we also have technical rescue capabilities. We extricate, we do rope rescue, pretty much all things rescue with the same capabilities as a SEAL. We can also shoot, move, and communicate. So we're attached to special operations teams. And so as that portion as a rescue PJ was winding down, I wanted to stay in the fight. And one of the units that was always in the fight was our Tier 1 unit. So that's a whole other selection process. And now you're working at a higher level. Now you're focused on hostage rescues, high-value targets, and you're working with the Tier 1 forces of the nation. So you're typical what you would see on TV for hostage rescues. Applied for that, assessed, got picked up. It's a whole other year of training, and then worked there for the past 8 to 10 years of my career. So deployed another 7 times there, so a total of 10 times. And over that time period of all those deployments, lost a lot of teammates, treated a lot of Americans, coalition forces, saw a lot of pretty terrible things, and started to acknowledge and recognize a lot of symptoms of PTSD that I didn't really initially think that they were PTSD symptoms. And really what it dawned on me, or when it came to a head, was I have four kids now. At that time, I had 3 kids. This was probably back in 2018 era. And my wife had sat me down with it and said, your 2 boys are scared of you. They were 7 and 11 at the time. And so that was a kick in the gut. And that really was a wake-up call, and fortunate that my wife was comfortable enough to be able to sit down and have that conversation with me, and courageous enough to do that, because I was always more comfortable to receive gunfire bullets than I was to be at home with the kids by myself and dealing with screaming and whining and whatnot. So the only way for me to get their attention was for me to get loud. That then scared them, and so that wasn't normal. That's not what normal was. So at our unit, the special unit that I was talking about, we have embedded specialists. So we have strength conditioning coaches, physical therapists, dietitians, psychologists, neuropsychologists, all these different people working and keep us operating at a high level. So I leaned on them and I went to them and I asked, more so that I thought I had TBIs. I had TBIs. I was like, hey, something's got to be going wrong with my brain. I can't remember people I've known for a decade. I'm getting very irritated. I'm very distant from everybody. I'm like, okay, let's do an MRI and let's do some cognitive tests. Did both of those. MRI actually came out pretty clean, no significant damage. And the cognitive test that I took, they said, we actually performed above average except for one particular area, which is attentiveness. And so this is typically what you see in people with severe PTSD. They can't pay attention to anything longer than 2 minutes. And I was like, well, I don't have that, I don't think. And they're like, well, let's set you up with the psychologist and just figure that out. So as reluctant as I was, I sat with the psychologist and went through some symptoms and things that I didn't realize were symptoms, which was distance from my family. Like, obviously, I could be pushing my daughter on the swing and then look back and realize she's not there on the swing anymore. And she had gotten off. I was pushing an empty swing. We're just not really paying attention, you know, not communicating very well. I'm not enjoying the job that I signed up for. I'm not, you know, people pay money to jump out of planes, and I wasn't enjoying jumping out of planes, rock climbing, scuba diving. I just didn't enjoy it. And then memory loss. So that was another symptom. And then I had a recurring dream. 6 nights a week, I was having the same dream. And to me, that wasn't a nightmare. It wasn't scary by any means. I wasn't waking up and choking my wife or anything. Like, I was just a recurring dream. And as I described that dream to the psychologist, she said, well, that's actually a nightmare, having nightmares. And it's the same theme every time. So if you do have severe PTSD, let's work through some of these things. And it goes all the way back to my training of when I first went through selection back in 2005, was the first teammate that I lost. So during our training, we did do some underwater or water confidence training, and he ended up passing out underwater, going to cardiac arrest, and dying. So that was the first instance of losing a teammate. And I kind of normalized that as this, I was prepared for this. And as time went on, as I pulled more and more, and I'm losing maybe 15 to 16 more teammates, where they got some combat accidents for them taking their own. So as I addressed a lot of these issues that I've been ignoring for years, I started enjoying my time again, sort of find my old motivation again. And I was a team leader of this group of guys, rescue specialists, so part of it is the rock climb and Duke Mountain Rescue. And one of the training iterations that was set up was to go out to Boise, Idaho, like more of a morale trip, a team builder trip, set up some easy climbs for the week or midweek, set up a bunch of climbs. Got to the final climb of the day, and one of our guys set up a rappel on the top of this cliff. It was about 60 to 70 feet. First guy gets down safely, everything's good to go. Second guy gets down about halfway, and the anchor fails. So the pieces of the nut and the camming device that was inside the rock. The rock shattered, and so one of our guys fell about 30 feet, hitting the rock. One of our other guys was tied into that anchor at the top, doing exactly what he was trained to do, tie into the anchor, keep himself safe. Well, that action of him being tied in there pulled him off the top. So the weight of the first guy that fell pulled him from the very top, and he fell into the rock. And so that immediately, me and one of the other guys rappelled down from the top. I mean, so four of us start treating our friend, but just fell 60 to 70 feet. And ultimately, after putting in a surgical airway, so cutting a hole in his neck, putting in a tube, doing a finger thoracotomy or a field chest tube just without the tube, and CPR for about 30 minutes, he ended up passing away. And so that kind of was the catalyst and the straw that broke the camel's back for me mentally, where I was like, I have really got to take a step back. And I lost teammates before. I had treated a lot of teammates, but this one was different for stateside. Talk about where we're going to go have beers and dinner that night. So pulled myself off a team and focused on utilizing those resources again. You know, I pretty much quit. I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I looked at myself as a failure as a leader and a failure as a medic, as a rescue specialist. And so I wanted to quit. I didn't want to do that. And after therapy and talking 2 months off, I came back to the team. The team wanted me back. Fulfilled an alert commitment, and within 24 hours of coming back, we got deployed on a short notice. So within a few hours of a phone call, we're on our way to go do a high-value target operation. So went and did that operation, spent a few months overseas. It was a very successful deployment, but back to being a leader, back to being myself. Very successful coming back from that deployment. We were actually getting ready to deploy again a few months later. So this is mid-February, early March. We're about to deploy again in May, deciding who's going where. In April, the investigation for the accident that killed Peter closes out. And when that closed out, they said, well, there's nothing you guys could have done to change the outcome or to change what happened or how it happened. But the military and leaders within there needed to hold somebody accountable, felt the need to hold somebody accountable, and to help me as the team leader accountable, and removed me from my position and from the unit that I had worked for. And so that threw me back into a depression, threw me back into, now I have a piece of paper saying it is my fault. I've been trying to convince my psychologist that it was my fault the whole time. I have a piece of paper, you know, pretty much verifying that it was my fault. And that threw me back into, I don't want to do the job. And I was given 30 days to PCS, or a very short time to move out of this water. And then I was told to clean out my cage and all my gear on a weekend so nobody else could see. And I was told I was no longer allowed in the building that I had spent almost a decade in and deployed 7x4 and pretty much cast away. And that opened my eyes to work. Like, okay, I got to start focusing on the next chapter of life. And the place I was going to be sent was going to be back to Vegas. And even though I enjoyed my time there, it was going to be a place that I was going to destroy myself and my family. And I thought, there's no way I can go back there with all these negative influences available to me. It's not going to be good for me and my future, my family. So the only way for me to have any sort of control of my life, especially second life, was to pursue a medical retirement. So I pursued a medical retirement with a diagnosis of PTSD and started looking at what does second life look like. And there then started my transition period of what took about a year of truly transitioning out. So there's my story. It's an up until transitioning.
I don't think people understand the gravity, especially of you special ops folks. I said this to someone recently. You special ops folks don't sit well in cubicles.
No.
And now I know why. Yeah. So you created your own business. Did you do that immediately? Did you know that the cubicle life was just not for you to sit in some cube farm at some corporation? Or did you try that? What did you do?
I was going to try it. So part of my healing process, I had a shoulder injury and I knew the environment I wanted to be in. I knew what had done so well for me, which was leaning on those resources that were available to me. The strength conditioning, health and wellness space, that was the industry I knew I wanted to be in. I knew I wanted to help other people that were like me, that, you know, were just dealing with all these traumas and didn't know what to do. And I knew what worked for me, so I wanted to bring those same things to them. I didn't know how to do that. And as I started formulating an idea, there's a company called Exos. I went there for a shoulder injury, got some physical rehab from them, and really enjoyed that environment, that space, maintain those relationships. And so I thought, you know what, like, I want to stay in this space. I'm going to get a degree. I'm going to go to school. This was the original plan. I'm going to go to school, get a degree in sports and fitness management, business management, sport fitness world. I'm going to work for Exos, intern there, work with them a little bit, get my feet under me, and then I'll start my own business that's in the health and wellness space. And more be a small business. I didn't want it to be large or anything like that. I just wanted a small, simple life after all my adventures and dodging death. And as I went into the space, I was offered an internship. I did the internship, though. It was in the sales enterprise section of Exos. And it's really how they acquire these different, it's business development. And that was not exciting to me. I was like, man, this is kind of freaking boring. And as great as it was seeing kind of behind the curtains of what corporate life is like. And man, like, this is, that's that life ain't for me. And however, I needed a job. And so I said, when this internship is done, is there a job there for me afterwards? He said, no. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And he said, well, you need to start doing what you said you're going to do in the beginning, and that's start your business, and I can help you do that. And so I was like, well, I don't know anything about business. I spent my entire life, adult life, carrying a gun and a med rock. How do I do a business? Mm-hmm. And so he pretty much held my hand through the whole process of starting, of filing articles of incorporation, of filing how to start a business, and really deciding if it should be a nonprofit or a for-profit. And so ultimately, leaned onto that nonprofit route because I wouldn't pay for the services that I'm offering out of my own pocket because I couldn't afford it. But there are people with the capability and the capacity that can help people like me, that want to help people like me, and they can help fund that bill and get these people help. So that's kind of what guided my path to doing what I'm doing. So it's a little bit of more different transition process. So I still had to do the VA and do all those processes with the VA, disability, and all that stuff. But when it goes into corporate world, folks in the special operations environment are very much more in tune with starting a business and entrepreneurship, because we're out there taking risks. We got into the special operations group because we knew the risks involved. We knew it was either do or die. It was either, you know, quit was not in our mind in the time of selection. So just like starting a nonprofit, there was no quit. There was, I'm going to do this. And there's risk in this. There's risk involved. And the entrepreneurship route became the route that I wanted to do. And not because I didn't want to have a boss. My boss is actually the board of directors and the people that
they write the checks.
The customers, right? Those are all the bosses. But I get to also an opportunity to lead a team. That's what I enjoy. I enjoy being a leader. Contrary to what that piece of paper stated, I knew deep down, and the team that was with me, Peter Jackson, and all the people that surrounded me, that was kind of my verification that I do know how to lead a team. I am a good team leader. So I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but.
No, I really like hearing your story. You and I had talked a little bit about your operating budget, and I always ask people, what's your intent? And Steve said exactly what everyone says, I want to give back. But I said to him, I know, as a small business owner, as a consultant for HR, and having helped other companies create this type of structure, it's expensive. You're looking for sponsors, partners, so that you can bring people in groups, not one to one to one to one. Shields and Stripes is the name of the company. Yeah. Nonprofit. And how would somebody get involved? What I also love, it's not just, it's paramilitary and military, right? Because you say first responders. How does someone get involved other than looking this up? Do they bring their own money to the table? Do you have, and then you open the seats? What do you do?
So those resources that I described, and you know, strength conditioning coaches, physical therapists, dietitians, psychologists, occupational therapists, all those resources that I had on my unit, those are the ones that I was like, okay, we got to often get to have this available to us. And so I interned for Exos. And when I asked Alex, is there a job? And he said, no, you got to start doing what you said you're going to do. I then said, hey, okay, well, if I start this, can I use Exos? Can I use your guys' services and bring those our veterans and first responders to your facility? And then I bring in psychologists. Now they get the full gamut of what I had available to me there on site. So we bring in, it's a 3-month full program. We bring our veterans and first responders to Exos for 3 weeks. And then they leave there in 9 weeks. The rest of the 9 weeks is telehealth model where they get a strength and strength. They get physical therapy there on site, a weekly massage, a weekly yoga, and then they get a dietitian consult, all the foods provided for them specifically for their diet. And then they have psych therapy in individual group in the afternoons. And then when they go home, they still have a strength coach, a physical therapist, a dietitian, and a psychologist. Now we incorporate the families. We provide them with tools to take home with them, whether that's donated foods from Therabody or donated PT bands and products so that they can utilize stuff at home. You know, they don't have much to use. Here's some bands that at least give you something. And then we incorporate the families because, as I described in my story, my wife is who saw it first. Families are the ones who see it first.
Yeah.
And so, how do we showcase it or at least incorporate the family to show that this is a treatment plan? It's not a workshop, it's not education, it's a treatment plan. So, how do individuals get involved? Well, they can go on the website and see. If they want to apply for the program, when the application is submitted, that goes to the clinical providers. I don't get this. I don't see who's submitting applications, and I shouldn't. I'm not a provider. I shouldn't see what your particular story is. So this goes to the therapist. They get to screen it, and what they're screening it for is mostly dependencies or addictions. So if they're addicted to drugs or alcohol or something like that, we're not a detox center, but we have partnerships with other organizations that are. So we'll refer them and even sometimes fund them to go to these detox centers. Outside of that, once they're done with that and they can get back to the program, they get selected, and it's about an 8-week selection process to make sure that they are ready for the next 3 months, that they're committed for this 3 months. They have to be committed and ready to heal because people are putting a lot of money on the line for these individuals to go through the program. If individuals want to get involved in a way that maybe they can't go through the program, maybe they don't want to, that it's not something that they're into, but they want to support another hero that to go through it, veteran or first responders, there's donations. We take donations of all times, you know, all types, any dollar, dollar, $1,000, $10,000, $15,000 per an individual. We have a cost breakdown that can showcase where that money goes and how it's broken down. So that's our biggest need, and any nonprofit's biggest need is going to be funding in some capacity.
Always, yeah.
And then the next step is always either follow us on social media. We have an Instagram, the LinkedIn accounts. Follow us and share our stuff there, share our content and information, because you never know who either has the capacity to give or needs to see this message. Those are our biggest, our big three of support asks, I guess.
Well, thanks so much for telling your transition story and your career story, even though, it sounds like everything's worked out perfectly. Just perfect. you just gave me 25 minutes of the high gloss. What's been the biggest suck of creating your own business, nonprofit?
Ooh, that's a great
dig deep, question. Steve.
The biggest challenge is, because this is a me challenge, this is a Steve challenge, and any business owner, business, especially somebody that operates a nonprofit, is the teams I worked in the special operations community, especially in the era that I was in, it was an all-male career field. That's just, even after changing it to opening up to females, there weren't any females inside as PJs or anything like that. So stepping back and getting used to, now we're probably a 90% run female organization.
Mm-hmm.
They're all military spouses and they're all very high performing. Mm-hmm. So communicating has been the biggest challenge for me to make sure that I'm communicating, and more so because all of them are volunteer. How do you keep somebody motivated that's not getting paid? How do you keep them engaged for 3 years? And fortunately, I've been blessed with, it's just an incredible team to stay with us, stay with me and believe in me that long. But it's also a challenge to make sure, how do I ensure that these folks who want to give, and they give so much back. The other challenge, we run 2 programs a year right now, and that's only limited by funding. Mm-hmm. Now, if we have the amount of funding that we want or we desire, we can run 9 programs and then ultimately build our own facility, which is what we want to do, is build our own program, build our own facility, and we can run a lot more programs inside there. And we have a high demand. We have a lot of people that want to go through our program that have applied before, and a lot of times their schedule doesn't align with our particular program schedule. So the challenge is the amount of people that are asking for help. and not being able to help every single one. Having to say, hey, not yet. You know, yeah. Somebody that's clearly in need, and because we don't have enough funding, yeah, somebody we have to say, like, man, not yet. And then that's pretty heartbreaking.
Well, thank you, Steve. You've been very brave, not only working through your PTS, but serving others is admirable. And my favorite part of this whole conversation is that you're saying paramilitary, you're saying public safety, first responders. I think oftentimes that those folks are often missed. This is a military to civilian career transition power hour, but those folks leaving fire or police service are also dealing with some of the same stressors and uncertainties with the same levels of trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you'll find is that a lot of them are actually veterans themselves. A lot of the first responders yes. are both veteran and first responders. So this is a natural transition for those folks.
And unlike clear deployments in Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Space Force, the public safety folks, the war is constant. It's daily. It's per shift. So they get ground down a lot faster, in my opinion. Sure. So thank you so much for sharing what you're doing and how you're doing it. You are just a few years out of your military transition, and I want to applaud you not only just for your vulnerability, but for what you're trying to do. And I'd like to keep my eyes on you. I have a few people I'd like you to speak to, some folks who've already been on the podcast. We featured Robert Hamilton Owens, also former PJ, and just some really incredible people. I'm sure you know John McCaskill, a former Navy SEAL commander, and he's got a really big thing going. So one of the favorite things recruiters like to do is connect people. So we'll be doing that for you. I'm going to close you out on your segment. Why don't you close out with any last alibis you'd like to tell our listeners?
When individuals take their own lives, yes. It's usually a fraction of a second. It's a five to 8 second window of that decision that's been made. Just wait. I've lost quite a few friends that you wouldn't have known that they were struggling. So if you are struggling, take that a few extra seconds and know that the storm that you're in will pass. And just like in selection or anything hard that you've accomplished, even getting in the cold plunge, at some point it will end. And it'll get better. So if that is you, if you are struggling, take those few extra seconds and instead of pulling the trigger or whatever method, wait.
Well said. Thank you. Steve Nisbett, N-I-S-B-E-T. You can also find him on LinkedIn. I spelled your name right, right? Did I? Okay. Shields and Stripes. Thank you so much. I'm Cheryl Cross. You're listening to the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour. We're going to take a brief break and roll into somebody who's been out of the military a minimum of 5 years. Stay tuned. Back. Welcome to the last segment of our Power Hour. This is where we bring someone who's been out of the military at least 5 years, but no more than 10. I try. And I only do that because I think that maybe after 10, people have maybe forgotten the suck of the transition, but this gentleman certainly hasn't. In fact, he became an accidental advocate by producing a wonderful tracking method for transition. It's a PDF, and we'll learn the name of it, but I'd like to introduce to you former Army Green Beret and O5, who's been out about 6 years, Kurt Windmuller. Hello, Kurt. How are you today?
Good, Cheryl. Appreciate you having me on. And I like the accidental advocate. I'm going to steal that if you don't mind.
You and I were talking before the recording about how you became an accidental advocate. Tell us a little bit about that and how that works into your transition out of the military.
In my 21st year of service, and I put in my paperwork to retire. And as soon as it came back, you know, approved and got that email, I was like, oh no, what have I done? So now the clock is ticking on you, right? So I had all these tasks, you know, that you have to complete, but I had no idea like when I was supposed to be doing certain things and if I was missing anything. So it was a pretty frustrating experience. I felt like the first person to ever retire out of the military, which is strange because like, you know, 200,000 people or something a year transition now. It's born out of that frustration. I put together that one pager PDF. It's like the greatest PowerPoint I ever made when I was as a staff officer, I guess. So, and I really did that for the other guys and gals that were working in the shop with me. So they were kind of senior folks too, majors, lieutenant colonels and above, and they were probably on the tail end of their career too. So I wanted to leave them something to help them out So they didn't have to go through that same, suffering and gray zone that I was had to deal with when I was getting out too. So that was how that was born.
And after that, you were invited on podcasts and everybody wanted to talk with you. Tell us a little bit about that journey and what the next year or so brought for you after transitioning and then becoming a transition expert.
So I posted that that chart, that one pager on LinkedIn as my first ever, post on LinkedIn. And it grew like wildfire. Like, so it went viral, I guess you could say. I got 175,000 views and people started reaching out to me and asking me questions and about transition. Like, they thought I was the expert for some reason because I made this chart. And then I just started, thinking about what they were asking me and trying to respond in a, in a way that, that they could relate to, or then, maybe I was going through the same thing or they're going through the same thing that I went through. And then got some folks to reach out to me to do podcast interviews to talk about the timeline. It just kind of worked myself into this transition space accidentally, like you said. So, and I enjoyed doing it because I felt like I was helping people out that were going through a tough time. So I enjoyed giving back to the community like that. And I just thought that, whatever I could do to help make it a little better for folks, then all the better. Because the military, it's not really their job to do that. They've got a different mission. So their transition is really largely up to you to be successful at it. So it's kind of an individual event, like, taking a PT test or whatever. So you can get plenty of help along the way. And there's lots of organizations to offer help and advice and for folks that are getting out. But it's still, it's still kind of a lonely process at times. So I felt that pain. And I wanted to kind of minimize that for other people going through the same.
Did you have a mentor, Kirk?
One of the folks I work with was a government service GS employee. And he was one of the only folks that I knew that had retired and came back that was recently retired. And he was like, you need to go to TAP class. And he was giving me time off to do this because he's my boss. So I had a boss who was sympathetic and kind of understood that because he had gone through that recently. So I was lucky to have that. A lot of folks do not, especially if you're in a unit that's in a remote location or maybe you don't have, contractors or GS folks in your unit and you're just a bunch of green suitors in there, then there's really nobody to talk to about it. Because everybody that gets out leaves and you don't see them again. They're like, that knowledge is gone. I used LinkedIn to find some other folks to connect with and just gathered information and kind of tried to build my own pathway out.
Since your retirement, which has been about 6 years, you've had a couple jobs. And since we're focused on career, let's pivot and talk about that. When you left the military, did you go directly into a DOD contracting role?
I did. That was my first role out of service. I basically took the uniform off and a couple months later, I was working back at the same command again as a contractor. And that was kind of the easy button, right? And I did that for a little while, about 3 years. And then I got a different job working in business development roles. And so that was something completely different. So it was another role change. Circumstances just lead you to certain opportunities. And that's just the way it works out. I'm actually on my third job since retiring now. So, and that is, there's nothing, wrong or unnatural about that. A lot of folks are change jobs or change roles multiple times when they get out. That's just the way it is. And it's kind of the natural order of things. So you don't know exactly what you want to do, maybe, when you get out. So you try something, and if it doesn't work out, then you can try something else. It's not a marriage, right? So you can go to a different job, go to a different company if you want to. But it's always best to do that if you're, it's upward growth, and you don't want to be a job hopper changing jobs every month. If you're changing jobs more often than you're changing your underwear, then you might have a problem. But there's nothing wrong with, changing roles and decide you want to do something different because your life changes too. Your kids get older. Maybe you have different requirements. Like right now I'm working in a part-time role. So I was working full-time for over 5 years since I left the military. Now I'm working, 30 something hours a week and it's a lot better fit for me now. So because that's just kind of what I wanted to do now at this point in my life. So
have you been making active choices for your career since you left?
I have. Yeah, I think so. Some of them were like my first role as a contractor. I was kind of nudged out because the contract ended and the position went to a different company. So in the process of that happening, you don't know whether you're going to get asked to come back in that role or not. So you kind of got to put the periscope up and look around for something else. And I found a business development role that was was remote work, you know, working from home, and the pay was better, like way better. So I ended up taking that role, and I like doing that, and like doing the traveling and learning a new skill set. So that was great to do that. And I'm kind of doing the business development role now with a different company. Wow. It's a small business, service disabled, veteran owned small business based out of Fayetteville that does intelligence work. So, but yeah, sometimes it's deliberate and sometimes it's fate, or sometimes it's a mix of both, Cheryl.
I agree. And I know that, you know, badge flips don't always work in the way of the incumbents. That's what they're called in recruiting, people who are with the company that's lost the contract. But hopefully you were interviewed and you were given a solid chance to join that other company. You said something earlier about one of the nonprofits that you worked with a little bit.
Project Transition USA. Yeah, it's an organization based out of Tampa. And they teach LinkedIn courses on MacDill Air Force Base to transitioning military personnel. So a lot of the folks have never been on LinkedIn before. They've been highly discouraged from being on any sort of social media. So it's kind of a new thing for them. But we teach them how to set up their profile, how to network to find their next job, and all the functionality of LinkedIn. Because a lot of it's not super intuitive, right? So you just have to learn it. So it's kind of a crash course in LinkedIn.
And you're very active on LinkedIn still. You said that you were less active, which surprised me because that's how I found you. And many people have talked about Kirk's PDF, by the way. Kirk's PDF has been sent through the interwebs for how long? Is it 6 years old now? Is it?
Yeah, about
that?
About 6 years now. This thing's been sent around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted a copy, go to Kirk's LinkedIn. I think it's there. Is that where they can find it, or do they just reach out and ask for it?
Right. It's on my profile page. So I've got it at the top there. If people want to click on it, they can download it as a PDF.
Yeah. And make sure that you, it's very small print. I wasn't able to see it on my phone. So definitely put it on your computer and blow it up. So you've been, I have this thing about special operators, and I don't want to say that they don't work well in cubicles, because some of them do. But by and large, as a recruiter, the folks that I interviewed and hired that were from special ops didn't really like the regular grind of a job. They didn't want to clock in, clock out. How did that affect you, or did that affect you when you got out, as you made your decision to move back and do the same work you did, just wearing it, no uniform?
Yeah, so I'd had, you know, within my military service, I'd had both, you know, operational jobs as an operator, as an SF guy on the team, and I had done staff jobs too. So I was kind of, you know, used to both, you know, being out in the field and being in the cubicle. And obviously being in the field is, I think, preferable, right? You know, you're out there training or doing real world stuff is always, real world's missions are always preferable to sitting in a cubicle. But, you know, when you start getting older, you know, the cubicle looks a little better and more comfortable, I think, you know, but that leads me to a great thought, I think, here for folks that might be listening. You know, your transition period is a great chance for you to kind of sit back and think about, like, why you want to work and what's, you know, a lot of people will get asked, like, what's their why, you know, and that's a tough question for a lot of folks. But I think why do you want to work, or why do you need to work, is probably a more basic an easier question for most people to ask. And then that kind of is going to lead you to, you know, things like, do you want to work in a cubicle? Do you want to work full-time or part-time? Or, you know, do you want to do remote work, you know, from home, or because you can live anywhere you want if you do, or do you want to live in a certain city? So all these questions you can start to flush out if you ask yourself that very basic question, I think, you know, it's like, why do you need to work? And then maybe that motivation or reason for people to work is going to really vary. So it's going to be like your own, like, personal algorithm you got to calculate there. You know, maybe you got kids you're trying to put through college, or maybe you're just trying to pay off that mortgage before you retire for real, or maybe you just get bored easily and you want to stay busy and you like the office environment and the camaraderie, and, you know, you get that in the military and you'll miss that when you get out. So all these things, you know, why do you want to work? Why do you need to work? And then that will help you kind of, I think, seek the right type of job and the right type of company that will make you, you know, want to stick around for them for a few years and work, and you'll be a happy camper, right? So, and then you won't be a job hopper.
Job hopping, as you said, Kirk, with reason, you know, contracts end with DOD contracting companies. And it's okay to say to a recruiter, you know, this just wasn't a fit. Embrace the choice. You are not a tree. You are not planted.
Well, that's right. And the way you find that out, you know, whether a company is going to be a good fit for you is, and you mentioned this before, you know, finding mentors and networking with people and maybe getting that DoD SkillBridge internship. And, you know, all those things, really what they are it's just a reconnaissance, right? So you're just kind of looking over the next horizon and seeing what's out there and, you know, talking with people that are in your field of interest, doing the things that you want to do. That's really how you narrow down, you know, like a sculptor, you know, starting with a giant block and you kind of whittling it down to a finely tuned product. You may not find exactly what you want to do, but you'll get closer, you get over the target, and that's what you want to get. Having a mentor, having informational interviews with folks, whether it's a cup of tea with them, you know, in person or, you know, over a Zoom call or something like that. As much as you can do of that, those sorts of intelligence work, if you want to put it in military parlance, the better off you're going to be. You're going to make a lot of assumptions and you need to kind of start ruling those out. Like, for example, one of the first things I did when I started transitioning was I signed up to get a PMP and I went to the Onward to Opportunity program, which is a fantastic program. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks into going through that coursework, I was like, I don't want to do PMP work. You know, I don't. All these folks in uniform were telling me, yeah, you got to get that PMP. You know, that's going to be a big salary bump. You know, like everybody gets it before they get out. I'm like, you know, that's not necessarily true. And I'm not, you know, down on the PMP. That's great for a lot of people. If you want to do project management, then you probably do need to get a PMP certification. But just as an example, like, you know, I was kind of doing that because everybody, I was getting bad advice or maybe advice from people that didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So I basically went down that path and luckily I was able to reverse. I'm like, hey, I don't want to do this. So you can start eliminating things and having discussions with folks. You'll be able to do that a lot, right? It's like, maybe I just don't want to do this type of work. It's just not for me. It's not the kind of environment. Maybe you don't want to join a, you know, fast paced environment, you know, like you were in before. Maybe you want to slow it down a little bit. So these are the kinds of things you're going to find out when you get out there and you start networking with people and talking to them and getting mentors and that sort of thing. So that is a must do when that is like a win theme for you in your transition is to network early.
Yes.
And often.
And people are confused about when to contact recruiters. I think, you know, recruiters hung the moon and the stars. I'm a recruiter. But you have to reach them at the certain point when you are job ready. And I don't mean in your mind. I mean your timeline. So if your availability timeline is 6 to 8 to 12 months out, go talk to the staff. Find people that work in those organizations that will give you their perspective. Ask for their personal story. Maybe they aren't military. Maybe they're civilians that just, you know, maybe they just started, or maybe they've worked there 20 years. Ask them their perspective. You will, as Kirk is saying, go on a reconnaissance and collect data. That is your job. And I recommend you do it more than 1 year ahead because your last year is going to be on fire with other things, not just looking for jobs. So let's go back to something you said. You mentioned the camaraderie. What else do you miss about the military that you have not found in the civilian workforce?
Well, I'm not sure that I miss it, but I think the routine and the daily battle rhythm, something that you're just, you just get used to that over years and decades of service, getting up 5 o'clock in the morning and going in for formation and PT and doing those sorts of things and having your, you know, having your life just kind of like planned out in front of you on the calendar. When you get out, it's not like that anymore. You're going to have way more free time than you ever imagined you'll have. And that's one of the super upsides of being out, right? But the downside is, you know, you got to discipline yourself to still maintain your fitness and your health and that sort of thing. So all those things are still important, but you're kind of on your own time to do that now, right? So I guess that's one of those unexpected things that I didn't imagine was like you're going to have more time, and more family time and whatnot. And it depended on the role you get afterwards too. But that's something you got to calculate in there too.
Time for yourself. What a concept.
Time for yourself. Yeah. So, you know what, that leads to another great thought here, which is, you know, have some hobbies, you know, at the ready when you get out. So if you're the kind of person that never had time to play golf or, you know, hang out with the kids or, you know, play sports or whatever, You got time for that now. Don't just sit around pining for the old days of being back on the team. You got to look forward right now, but not backwards.
Would you recommend people take a break if they're able to financially between service and working in the civilian workforce?
100%. So you're going to have the opportunity to take, in some cases, you can take a two to three months of leave, and I recommend saving up the maximum amount you can for your transition. Cause you're going to, when you're on leave, you're still making that housing allowance, all those other benefits too. But when you're out and you're out processed and you're out of uniform, you're not right. So you need to have some money saved up, have some leave saved up, and then absolutely, take a vacation. And kind of the best scenario you can set yourself up for is that you have that job locked in, early on in your, transition leave, right? So you're doing your interviews and your job hunting there. And if you can get some, find something that you like and, sign on the dotted line with that new company and they say, well, maybe you want to start a few months back and push you back if they can. I mean, some people want to start you right away, but if you can take a month or two off, that's going to be the time in your life when you really can relax for probably the first time, So I highly recommend taking a vacation, taking some time off and just decompressing before you start your next career and jumping into that. Because once you get onto that trade, it could be a very busy time in your life because you're learning a new profession, learning new ins and outs of the company that you're working for and probably doing some travel depending on what you're doing. But it could be very busy too. So do take some time off.
A lot of the leaders I speak to say that it was very hard for them to speak in front of their troops, their battalion, their brigade, whatever squad, about me. If they ever stood on a stage or in front of a group of people and talked about themselves, it would be, you don't do that. It's we, it's the mission. So to be mission mindset and then go into the civilian workforce where it is me, I, not necessarily we. Did you find that? Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's a tough one to get used to, Cheryl, because you're, like you said, you're doing everything as a team. You kind of live and die as a team when you're in the military, and it's always about teamwork makes a dream work, right? So when you get out, especially when you're interviewing for a job too, you're going to want to be able to talk about your accomplishments, right? Not your team's, because the people interviewing you don't care what other people did. They want to hear what you did, right? So you're going to be able to talk comfortably about yourself and your own successes and just be able to clearly articulate those to a interview panel. And it's, you shouldn't be ashamed of doing that. I mean, you did a lot of great stuff when you were in the service. So you just got to get used to saying I instead of we. That's a big change for a lot of folks, and it's not selfish. It's, you got to land that job. And once you get into that role, then go back to, the teamwork and working together to get things done. So, but for the interview, you got to say, I did this, I did that, this is what I accomplished.
Yeah. Tough. Well, good luck on that. And to those of you who are listening, I want Kirk, you to spell your name. A lot of folks are just listening on the podcast and not watching us on YouTube. So go ahead and spell your name out so folks can reach you on LinkedIn and look for that great PDF.
Sure. It's Kirk, K-I-R-K, last name Windmuller, W-I-N-D-M-U-E-L-L-E-R. But I've got not only that chart, the PDF you mentioned on there, but I've got links to some of the articles that I wrote for the Military Times as well about transition-related topics too. So your viewers or listeners will find those useful as well. But there's probably about a dozen of them on there that they can check out. Reach out to me on LinkedIn.
I want to just say thank you for being available. I tracked you down. I saw all that you've contributed to this space, even though you say you've taken a bit of a break. I think this might be your comeback tour there, Kirk. I want to say thank you first for what you're doing to give back. I think that as people leave the military, the farther away they get, they forget they've moved on. And that's why this show is so important to raise the voices. And I hope you never forget. I hope you continue to advocate and continue to write guides and PDFs and offer your advice. It's invaluable.
Well, I appreciate that. And thanks for what you're doing to get the message out there, too. You've got a lot of great interviews with folks on there. I've been through several of them. And these are folks that are fresh out of the box, right? They're giving great advice on there, too. So that's, you definitely want to want to hear what they have to say too, because their information is a little more up to date than mine. Because some of the, you know, policies change and you know, benefits change and that sort of thing. But I think the basics don't change, and the underlying principles of transition aren't going to change. And that's, you know, start early, build that network, and build up leave and some money in that nest egg, and get your finances in order. If you do those things, I think you're setting yourself up for a much easier transition. Make sure you understand why you want to work and all the things that you didn't like, maybe like about life in the military, being away from your family and that sort of thing. So if that's stuff that bothered you back then, you know, don't go back into the same frying pan there. Go, you know, find something different to do that gives you a little more freedom and a little more, you know, better suited towards your lifestyle, I guess. So just keep that in mind. And you can do anything you want when you get out of the military. It's just a matter of, you know, preparing yourself and the further away that thing is that you want to do from what you were doing in the military, probably the more advanced preparation it's going to take. You know, I mean, if you want to be a doctor, you're going to have to go to med school. It's going to take a long lead time there. But if you're going to do this, you know, take the uniform off and you're an intelligence analyst and you want to do intel analyst work, that's a pretty easy transition. Or you're pilot and you want to be a pilot, civilian pilot, you know, those are going to be much easier transitions. But it's the ones where you're really doing something completely different that's, you're going to be more stressful and more prep time and you know, you just got to put a little bit more lead time into that. So, and more thought. So anyway, but I think that's a good one to end on.
We've been listening to Kirk Windmuller, and he is our last guest for the hour. So we're going to close up this whole Power Hour with just a huge thanks. I'm Cheryl Cross. I'm your host. It's the Military to Civilian Career Transition Power Hour, the longest name. I swear my next podcast is going to be shorter because that's a mouthful. But we're going to be right back after this very brief break and wrap up the show.